Okay, we'll do a little bit of Parshas Chukas. Even though our practice is to focus on Sheni, as far as I can tell, I don't think we had the opportunity to learn Chukas at all last year. So I think whatever was going on that week. So we'll take a look at topics in both of the first two Aliyahs. Briefly look a little bit at some of the major themes in this parsha, which itself is a major theme of the whole Torah. And that's how it gets some of the phrasing, which is so striking. Zos chukas ha-Torah. And that's how the parsha essentially begins. It could have used language more specific, as we find elsewhere in Chumash. And yet it uses this dramatic language. This is the rule of the Torah. And in doing so, it focuses on this specific context, the Parah Adumah, in two ways. One is the Parah Adumah is held up as the paradigmatic chok, which itself is not such an obvious point, because it's not the only chok in the Torah. We have a lot of chukim. Lubavitch Rebbe has an essay about this where he notes that it's not so much about it being a chok in the classic sense, the way we use it, as opposed to Mishpatim. And we talk about Mishpatim versus Chukim. So then we mean, okay, we have mitzvahs that we think we understand on some level, a civil law, and we have mitzvahs that are more ritually oriented, that we don't necessarily know what they're about. But Parah Adumah is a Chok in a different sense. It's called a Chok because of its internal stira, because of how it contradicts itself. And he focuses on other internal steers, not just on the one that we focus on most famously, that it is metahar temeim, that it conveys purity, but it also has the power to convey impurity, but also the fact that it takes place outside of the Beis HaMikdash, and yet it is called a chatas, it's called a karban, certain inherent stiras inside of the very concept of the Parah Adumah. So that's where we get to the mystery a little bit. But in any event, it's not just that that's getting all the attention, but it's that this is also chukas ha-Torah, this is the chok that represents the entire Torah. So Rav Moshe Feinstein talks about this a little bit in his comments in his Darish Moshe, where he notes that we find this also by Kalim, by Geulei Nachrim, and he suggests that that represents the other kind of halacha, that you can understand why you have to kasher your Kalim if your Kalim took in non-kosher food. So that's a much more understandable concept. And the idea that the Torah uses the word Zos Chukas HaTorah in both contexts is a way of saying that we have to treat them all the same way. That we have to treat even those mitzvot that we don't understand at all, Ki Hu Zeh, with the same type of reverence as the mitzvot that we do understand in a much more absolute way. He also goes on to note that perhaps the whole idea of the stira within the Parah Adumah is, in a way, what the Torah is telling us is true about everything. That everything is about balancing different opposing ideas in the service of God. That here the idea of Tumah and Tara coming together in one context, it's not as unusual as it sounds. That we have a place for all kinds of contradictory mitos within Avodas Hashem. There are times when we have to be it seems like we have to be very forceful with people, and there are times when we have to be very nice to people. There are times when we're very generous, and there are times when we're very restrained. There are all kinds of different midos in the Torah, midos that the Torah calls upon us to use, which seem to contradict each other. And nonetheless, that's the message of the Parsha. The Parsha is that just like we find in Parah Adumah, the contradictory elements are brought into one place, so too the Torah does that all the time. Zos Chukas HaTorah, that's basically the way the Torah operates. It's not so unusual. And we shouldn't be so surprised. And he then goes on to suggest an interesting idea that the Gemara in the end of Maseches Brachos, which some have commented, has to be a joke because it's so hard to take on its pashtus level. When the Gemara says that the idea of Talmidei Chachamim Marbim Shalom Ba'olam, actually four mesechtes end that way. I mean, it's hard to understand what it can mean on a pashtus level that Talmidei Chachamim bring peace to the world if it's so famous for machlokas, or so famous for arguing? How could you say they bring peace to the world? So he wants to suggest along these lines that we have the need to reconcile conflicting midos in life. That's basically what the Torah tells us to do, to take this midah in this direction and that midah in that direction, and to know how to control it, to know how to use it. And you might make a mistake. So you might think, for example, okay, I should steal money for a tzedakah because that's where these contradictory midos are going to take me. And so therefore we need a Torah to tell us, no, that's not a case where you bring those two contradictory midos into one place. We need a code to tell us how to make shalom between the conflicting attitudes that all have to coexist with inside of us, and that's really what's represented by the Parah Aduma, and that's what it means, Zos Chukas HaTorah. It's an interesting suggestion. Others have said, in a more straightforward sense, like Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says in his Emes LeYaakov, that the idea is that just like the Parah Aduma is mysterious, just like it requires us to recognize by its very nature that it's above and beyond us, so too we have to understand the whole of Torah is that way, and that if we want to access any wisdom, then we have to have a commitment to that recognition, that we have to understand that the Torah calls upon us to submit to a deeper and higher and loftier principle than we're able to comprehend. And that's going to be what the Torah is going to request of us. So in any event, we're told about this process to do in the case of Tumas Meis, in the case of the impurity that is conferred by somebody dying. And the Ora Chaim has a whole discussion here about this whole concept of Tumas Meis, where he explains that Tuma is a function of the lack of Kedusha not never having been there in the first place, but the fact that Kedusha Davka was there and Kedusha has left. So specifically, so a Jewish person who's dedicated to the goal of mitzvah, still dedicated to the aspect of Kedusha. The Beis Halevi has a whole essay about this in his introduction to his Shuvas, that Jews are Tashmishei Kedusha because they are set aside for jobs of holiness. So when somebody dies and all of that Kedusha is now removed, so that's what we call Tumah. That's what we have this idea that there is a concept of impurity. So there were those who wanted to suggest, the Avnei Nezer wanted to say based on that, so we know a Kohen is not allowed to come into contact with Tumas Meis. He says maybe that's also why he's not allowed to marry a Grusha, because if a woman was never married, so there never was a marriage there. Okay, so then the Kedusha of marriage, the Gemara says that Ishu Isha Mzachu Shechina Beinehem, that when they come together, the Shechina is with them. So then if there was a divorce, so then apparently the Shechina left. So similar to a death, that there was a Kedusha there that's no longer there. So perhaps a Kohen is also to a Grusha. For that reason, it's similar to Tumas Meis. That's what the Avnei Nezer wanted to suggest. So then others raised the question. There's a contemporary sefer called the Beichia, where he discusses this question that, so why should we allow Kohen to marry an almana? She also had a marriage in her life that is no longer there. The death of her husband took away that Kedusha. So he wanted to suggest that maybe a Kadosh Baruch Hu comes to support the almana, so he counteracts that lack of Kedusha by providing his constant presence and support of the almana. But if it's a simple divorce, so then maybe that's what we mean, the Kedusha has gone, and therefore the Shechina has gone, and therefore it's also to a Kohen. It's an interesting idea. So in any event, the Pasuk goes on to tell us about this whole idea of the Parah Aduma, and this is not the only time of the year that we read this. As we know, we read it this Shabbos, but we also read it a few months ago, not so long ago, before Pesach. We read about this. We read these same psukim, and we didn't call it Chukas then, we called it Parshas Parah. So Parshas Parah is one of the four Parshias, which we generally assume are Drabanan. Amalek is maybe an exception to that. That's a mitzvah in the Torah, Zechiras Amalek. Happens to be that not all the Rishonim even agreed to that much. The Rambam writes the Dalet Parshias of Drabanan. But not only is Amalek a possible exception, but there are those who suggest that reading Parshas Chukas at that time, what we call Parshas Parah then, is itself a mitzvah d'oraisa. The Rishonim in the beginning of the second Parak of Bracha, some of the Rishonim have such a statement that reading Parshas Para is a mitzvah min haTorah. The Gemara there talks about the question of whether Divrei Torah have to be Belashon HaKodesh or could they be in any language. So the Rishonim ask, well, what are we talking about? For what purpose? For giving a shir? For learning? No one ever said you have to learn only Belashon HaKodesh. That can't be. And it can't be it's about laning either, because laning is a din d'rabbanan, and the Gemara quotes Pesukim to try to figure this out. So it can't be trying to figure out what the rule is for a din d'rabbanan. So Tosfos says that there are a couple of times when you read something and it's a chiyuv min haTorah. So some of the other Rishonim, besides Tosfos, they take a similar approach, but they throw in, yeah, not just Parsha Zachar, for example, but maybe also Parsha Parah. So where do you get that idea from, that Parshas Parah is a chiyuv min haTorah? Why should that be? It's not really clear how that's indicated at all. So the Meshech Chachma over here suggests that we have a din that you have to separate the Jews from Tuma. So maybe this is a reflection of that. You have to instruct the Jews about Tuma. So we read this section about Tuma's mace in order to make that point. That's an interesting idea. The Aruch HaShulchan has a different approach. The Aruch HaShulchan says that this idea, this concept of the Parah Aduma, so the Torah says that it has to be something that's around forever. So we don't have, uses the word Olam here somewhere. So the Parah Aduma we don't really practice today. We don't really have circumstances in order to practice it. So then how do we fulfill the idea that it has to be done all the time? So maybe just like the Karbanos in general, that here it is a Chukas Olam, the Pasuk Yud. So how is it a Chukas Olam if nowadays we don't talk about it at all? So perhaps it's in the same spirit as we learn the Karbanos. So we know that the Gemara says, Mishnah says in Menachos and Daf Kuf Yud, that when we don't have a Beis HaMikdash to bring Karbanos, so we study the Karbanos, Neshama Parim Sosenu, and so too on the Yom Tovim, so we daven Musaf, and we lane about the Karbanos that were on the Yom Tovim. So too, maybe we have the Chiyuv min haTorah to lane this section, so that we'll be able to keep the idea of Parah Aduma in practice, so to speak, that studying it is as if we're doing it, so it's as if it's still being performed. Hi. He said that it's a fulfillment of the idea of Hisartim b'nei Yisrael mitumasam, that you have to try to keep the Jews separated from Tumah, so you have to instruct them about the rules of Tumah. So how do you do that? Get this out of the way. So how do you do that? So maybe you do that by instructing them of the principles of Tumah, and that's what maybe this is accomplishing. Maybe this is kind of giving a public shiur about Tumah. But there is a whole different approach, a very fascinating approach that a number of the Achronim had. The Malbim has this in his Sefer on Halacha called Aretz HaSachayim, and the Tshuvas Arugas HaBosim has this as well, that maybe we could suggest a more creative approach, that there is a pasuk in Parshas Ekev, which seems to tell us that there's an obligation to remember not just Amalek, Shabbos, things like that, but there's an obligation also to remember the Cheta Egel. The Pasuk says, Zachar es asher hiksafta es Hashem Elokecha b'midbar. You should remember how you angered God in the desert. And the Ramban writes, he thinks that this should be included among the Tariq mitzvahs, that this is something, the Ramban doesn't bring it, but the Ramban thinks that this should be brought, this should be included in the mitzvah HaTorah to remember the Cheta Egel. So then how come we don't do it? We don't have a whole Shabbos that's devoted to the Cheta Egel, just like we have a Shabbos devoted to a Malik, or like we make Kiddush every Shabbos to fulfill the mitzvah of Zechiras HaShabbos, or like we have a Holy Yontif to a daily obligation of Zechiras Yisias Mitzrayim. So what do we do about the Egel Azav? So there are those who want to suggest, like the Malbim and the Arugas HaBosam, that we can make a Shidduch here. That we could say that we have a mitzvah without a fulfillment, and maybe we have a din without a source, we could put them together. That maybe the mitzvah to remember what happened in the desert, to remember the Cheta Egel, is fulfilled through the idea of reading about the Parah Adumah. I know that Rashi quotes over here from Rav Moshe Hadarshan that the idea, the imagery of the Parah Aduma is that the mother should come and clean up the mess that the child made. The mother, the cow, was the mother of an egel. So the imagery is, let the cow come and clean up the mess of the child. So if that's the idea, that the Parah Aduma is a kapara for the chet egel, so then perhaps you could understand. The Beis Halevi has a drasha about that as well, where he says that, you know, it plugs into this whole idea that Parah Aduma is about complete submission to God. We don't understand what it's about, so the whole thing is about submission. So too, that comes to do the opposite of the Egel Azav. The Egel Azav was Avodah Zarah. It was all about not submitting to God because we didn't think we understood His plan. So the Parah Aduma is a takana for that. It goes in the opposite direction. Some say it a little bit more technically, that if it wasn't for the Echet Egel, they wouldn't have died, and the Parah Aduma is there to clean up Tumas Meis. Whatever it is, we have this imagery that the Parah Aduma is there to fix the Egel Hazav. So perhaps the idea of remembering the Echet Egel, why do we want to do such a thing? We want to be mevaz ourselves? We want to focus on our downfall? Presumably not. Presumably the idea is that we want to remember the Chet HaEgel because we want to remember that we can do tshuva, that it's possible to come back. That's what the Gemara says in Masechah Shabbos. And then regarding the whole Chet HaEgel, the Gemara says, Lo hayu bnei Yisrael ruyim lo somaisa elokidei lahoros tshuva l'rabim, that the reason the Chet HaEgel happened was necessary for history in order to show what the process of tshuva is. So if that's really our focus, that we want to show that we can come back from this, so then maybe that's why we choose to have a more cheerful fulfillment of the mitzvah instead of focusing on the Aveira itself. When we're told to remember this episode, we focus instead on the Kapara. So that's all very well and good if you believe that that's the purpose of the mitzvah. If the purpose of the mitzvah is to remember that you can do tshuva, so then, okay, so then maybe Taka the Parah Aduma is a good stand-in. But there are those who say differently. I think the Kedushas Levi maybe has like this in his Sefer, where he has a whole section on the Zechiras with Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, that the purpose of remembering the Chet HaEgel is a whole different thing. It's that we should never feel too smug. We should never feel too comfortable in our spiritual status, that we think that, oh, okay, so we're at such a high level, we can't sin. So look, the Jews, right after they got the Torah, they're on such a high level. And yet, even then, they're able to have this downfall of the Chet HaEgel. So the message is that we have to have a constant vigilance. We have to recognize that it's always possible for us to fall no matter where we're coming from. So if that's the case, does the Parah Aduma still work as a stand-in? Does it still work as a replacement for that concept? So you could say that, yeah, it does very much so, because maybe this whole idea of this paradox that's contained within the Parah Aduma, the notion that at the same time it's metahar and metame, that's so hard for us to accept. Maybe the notion is that the message we're being taught is that there isn't anything that's absolutely safe. You don't say, okay, I'm involved in something religious now. It's metahar, it's a source of tahara, it can only do good things. You recognize that even when you're doing a religious activity, you're involved with religious people, no matter how you identify, it's still possible for a person to stumble, and to stumble badly. It's still possible for that which is supposed to be metahar to end up being metame. You never have a situation where you can give up your own personal vigilance and your own personal care and attention to what you're doing. And therefore, perhaps that's the message of both the Chet HaEgel and the Parah Aduma, and therefore maybe Parah Aduma is taka a good stand-in for this idea. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a different mahalach to this. I think Rav Moshe Feinstein, either Rav Moshe or Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, has this idea that they think you can really say the whole thing differently. He says, you don't have to be so veiled and so subtle. So it's not so sure that the mitzvah of Zachar Asher Hiktzavta is actually talking about the Egel Azav. It's not so clear that's what the pasuk means, right? Remember how you angered God in the Midbar. So the truth is, we angered God a few times in the Midbar. Maybe it's talking about something else. So he wants to suggest that actually maybe it's talking about Mara. And that paraduma, which was taught, that mara, is taught there as a kapara, because the whole message of mara is that even though the water was bitter, God's word makes it sweet. That submission again to God's will is what directs life. So paraduma has that message specifically in the context of mara, and that's why we read that as a fulfillment of yes, of that pasuk, but not because it has anything to do with the egel azav, but because it's about a kapara for the chait of Morris. So that's an interesting angle that comes at it from a different direction. And that could be true as well. It's another spin. It's interesting to bring a little synergy to connect. So this year she was learning Bava Metzia. Next year she was learning Shabbos. This week everyone's learning Chukas. So to connect those all together. So when they have this requirement here, that the pasuk says Asher lo ala aleha ol, that you have to have a paraduma that hasn't ever worked, that hasn't carried a burden. And the Gemara Maseches Otam and Vav Amud Aleph has a whole discussion about what type of avodos passes and what doesn't. And through a series of limudim with Egla Rufa, so we find the Gemara Maseches Bav Mitzi in the second parak. Our share, we did a little bit of the second parak in the beginning of the year. So the Gemara and Daf Lamed, it's a little farther than where we got. The Gemara Daf Lamed above Metzia discusses this idea, and Tosus over there discusses that there is a requirement that in order for the avoda of whatever work is done with a para aduma that would disqualify it, or let's say if it was mated with a male intentionally, the Mishnah discusses in para, in the second parak of para, so then that disqualifies the para, assuming that it was something that the owner was happy with. It was what we would say would be called nichale. So the Rishonim, Tosfos and Bava Metzi and Daf Lamed and the Ran and the Shittim Mekubetzes and others ask that how's that going to happen? Right? If this avoda or this mating is going to disqualify the Para Aduma, so the owner is going to end up with a big loss. Right? So won't that by definition mean that it's not going to be nichale? He's not going to be too happy with it. So if that's the case, how's it ever going to happen that the standard is going to be fulfilled? That in order for it to be the type of avoda that's going to disqualify the para, it has to be acceptable to the owner. But the very fact that it's going to disqualify the para will not be acceptable to the owner, who's going to lose out a lot of money. So the Rishonim deal with this, Tosfos deals with it, and the Ran deals with it, and they give different approaches. And either that you look at it abstractly, and you say, well, what would have been if it didn't disqualify the Parah, that's the standard. Or how would it be viewed by another Parah that doesn't have this whole issue? Some Rishonim say it that way. Or the Ran says you just can't have a situation where Isuro Hetero, because your head will explode. Basically, can't have a situation where the very thing that makes it a problem is that which makes it okay, because your head will explode, it can't be. It's an internal contradiction. So they have different ways of saying that essentially we don't factor that in. The fact that the owner is going to be upset to lose the money that he get for the para aduma, that's not a part of the equation in assessing whether he is theoretically happy with what's happening to the para. So this is invoked, halacha l'maisa, a lot. You might say, what are you talking about? How many shilas of paraduma do you hear discussed halacha l'maisa nowadays? So those Rishonim and Bava Metzia that talk about this are all invoked in the discussion in Hilchos Shabbos. So it's a segue again between Bava Metzia and Shabbos. You were all at the Siyum this morning where we finished Bava Metzia and started Masechet Shabbos. So a connection between the two. So we know that when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, so we have a concept of a psik resha. That's the concept in Shabbos, the concept really in Kol Torah Kula, but it's just very relevant to Masechet Shabbos, that in Hilchos Shabbos, that if you do an action, and that action will definitely trigger another action, that's not your direct intent, action A will definitely bring about action B, a psik resha means it's definitely going to happen, so then you could be chayiv for that as long as it's nichale, as long as it's something that you're happy with. If the result is something that you'd like, so then that's psik resha de nichale, and you are chayiv for that. So there is a discussion, la halacha, what about a situation where you're not happy about the result? Okay, so that's Psik Reisha Delon Nichle. According to one view in Rishonim, the Arach, that should be Mutter Lagamri, it's not even Asa Midrabanan. We probably paskin against the Arach, that's an Issa Drabanan, but Lo Nichle makes a big difference. It either knocks it down to a Drabanan, or according to the Arach, it's actually Mutter. So what if I say it's Lo Nichle, I'm not happy with what happened because of the Isser, because it brings about a Malacha. So therefore, that is what's bothering me. So then, can we call up Psik Reisha de Lo Nichle if that's what makes it Lo Nichle? So the poskim all refer to this looking in Bav Metzia and this Mishnah in Parah. It talks about the Parah Aduma. It says you can't factor that in. The fact that it's going to have this halachic implication that the animal would be disqualified, we don't factor that in. Whatever reason you want to give, the Ron's reason that your head will explode, or the other Rishonim say we look at it without that component. So Hilchos Shabbos should be treated the same way. We don't factor in the fact that there's going to be an Avera that's coming out of this. So that's the approach many poskim took to that question. Just Liyuna Ba'alma, just theoretically, I wonder if there's room to possibly distinguish between the two. I'm not sure if the Raya is 100% comparable in both directions. That, first of all, in the case of the Parah Aduma, it's not really the halachic issue that bothers you. It's the monetary issue that bothers you, which is caused by a halachic factor, that since your Parah Aduma is now halachically disqualified, you're going to lose out on dollars and cents from selling the Parah Aduma. So it's not the halacha that bothers you. In the case of Shabbos, it's the halacha that bothers you, so that's just a difference, whether it's relevant or not. But another difference maybe goes in the other direction, is that in the case of the Parah Aduma, you could say, listen, what happened, you're happy with. The work of the avoda for this animal, or the mating of this animal, that you would be happy with. The fact that there's a later consequence, that now you can't sell it as a Parah Aduma, so that's separate, that's something that comes afterwards. But in the case of Chil Shabbos, where you don't have an onesh b'zman hazeh, it's really the avera that bothers you, the avera itself. So then you could say, no, the whole ma'isa is not nichaleh, because I don't want the avera. Not because of the consequences going to happen later. We don't have a Bezdin to execute us anyway. It's not that that bothers us. It's the Avera itself. So you really don't want the Maisa itself because of the Avera. I don't know if that necessarily should mean it's not Nichole, but it's not necessarily exactly the same kind of situation as you find by the Parah Aduma. There does seem to be some room to distinguish. So in general, the poskim still, even without the Parah Aduma, Raya are hesitant, or more than hesitant, to say that that should factor in, because then you'll say, okay, the whole concept falls away, so nobody wants the Avera. So therefore, by definition, if you're going to say Lo Nichle Machmas Isser is considered to be Lo Nichle, so then you've knocked out every Psik Reisha, because it's always Lo Nichle. Also not sure if that's true. There could still be room to say that, no, sometimes you really want the result. So yeah, if you're going to say, well, I'll do action A and provoke action B, which I'm happy about, but I'll just say I'm not happy about it because of the Chil Shabbos, all right, so that's not really an honest approach. But if you really don't want action B to happen, you really wish you could stop it from happening, and the whole reason you don't want it to happen is because of the Chil Shabbos, maybe there's a tzad to say differently. Don't know, not the halacha l'maisa, but maybe there is room to actually say that the isser that's involved maybe should also factor into Lo Nichle. So part of that is this whole question, again, of to what extent is the standard that we find by Parah Aduma relevant and comparable to the question that we find in Hilchos Shabbos. So it's a little bit of an overlap between Chukas and Bav Metzia and Shabbos that's worth considering. There is another famous line. So this whole idea of Zos Chukas HaTorah, which was already pretty dramatic, and already got a lot of discussion, so then it comes up again. And so then the parasha continues a little bit later, and it says something similar in Pasuk Yudalit. It says, Zos HaTorah, Adam Ki Amos Bo'oho. So it tells us again about Tumas Meis, with a very dramatic statement, which seems to be too broad, not just the specific din, but Zos HaTorah, this is the whole Torah. So what does it mean by telling us that? So the Gemara Maseches Brachos has a statement which seems to be non-halachic. And also, it will scare your parents if you come home from yeshiva and you say this line over as your Dvar Torah for Shabbos, they're not going to want to send you back to yeshiva next week. Because the Gemara says in the end of Brachas, what does it mean, Zosa Torah Adam Kiyomus Ba'ohel? It means that Ein Divrei Torah Miskaimim, Divrei Torah are only going to be successful, only going to be fulfilled, but Mishamei Misatzmoleim, somebody who basically makes himself dead, who kills himself over them. So what does that mean? Can't mean what it sounds like. But even in a figurative sense, it's hard to understand. You know, we say, V'chai Behem, the Torah is meant to live by, and we also believe, even in a more metaphorical sense, that we have to be able to balance our human needs with learning. So what does it mean when it says that the Torah is only going to be successful with somebody who, so to speak, is mamis himself regarding the Torah? Many suggest that it has to do with minimizing the distractions of this world and really cutting himself off from those pleasures to whatever extent. Again, it's also a little bit hard to understand. So there are those who explain. I've heard Abba Yitzchak Cohen Shlita to explain it in this way. But you have to tell a story first in order to make the point. The story is a little bit of a joke, but it does explain the point anyway, despite it being somewhat of a joke. That there are many stories that are told about Herschel Ostropolier. Herschel Ostropolier is a familiar name. So he was a classic Jewish wit, Jewish clown. There are many jokes told about him. So there was one story that was told that he was visiting a town, and there was a very wealthy man there who had some shtick that he came up with. He had this plan that he would pretend to be very generous, and really he wasn't. He would invite people over to his house for a meal. He'd invite the poor people to his house for a meal, and he'd look like he's very generous. He'd have these aniyim come, and he'd bring out these sumptuous meals, these wonderful, lavish meals. Looks like he's really giving this person a lot. But at the same time, he would engage the person in conversation the whole time. So he'd be talking to this person. So the person had to be polite. His host is talking, so he has to respond. So because he's talking to the host, he doesn't get a chance to eat. And by the time the host finishes asking his questions, so then the waiters have taken away all the food. He hasn't actually given him anything. So the host gets to look like he's being all generous and really doesn't have to give away anything. So Herschel Ostropolier said, I know how to deal with this guy. Don't worry. I'll figure it out. So Herschel gets himself an invitation to this guy's house. And as expected, so first the person puts out a very lavish first course. And Herschel is looking forward to eating it. And he's about to take his first bite. And just as expected, the host says, oh, tell me, you say you're from Ostropol. You know, I happen to be close friends with the Rav of Ostropol. Tell me, how's he doing? So Herschel says, the Rav, he's dead. And the guy is totally shocked. He can't believe it. He's stunned. So while the guy's regaining his composure, Herschel quickly eats up the whole first course. So then he manages to get the first course consumed. So then they bring out the second course. And then the guy says, he's finally caught his composure a little bit. And he says, wow, I can't believe that. That's terrible. I was such good friends with him. I spoke to him just last week. That's such terrible news for his wife, the Rebbetzin. Tell me, how is the Rebbetzin dealing with this? So Herschel says, the Rebbetzin? She's dead too. So the guy's totally blown away. Can't believe it. Rav, the Rebbe's both dead, so he's stunned for another minute. And Herschel quickly chaps a rye and eats the whole second course. So then they finally bring out the dessert, and this guy starts the conversation again. He's regained himself again. And he says to Herschel, he says, can't believe this, the Rav and the Rebbetzin. So who took over? Who's running the show now in Ostropol? Is the Shamish running the shul? So Herschel says, the Shamish? He's dead too. I can't believe it. He's totally stunned. Herschel finishes the last course. So after the whole meal is over and Herschel's been successful, he's been able to eat everything. So then the host says, I can't believe it, the Rav, the Rebbetzin, the Shamish. What was there, some kind of plague in Ostropol? Well, what happened? So Herschel said, no. When I'm eating, everyone's dead. There's nothing else in the world. There's nothing else going on. So Rabbi Cohen has made the point in a similar sense. He says the person who has the attitude is so focused that when he's learning, nothing else is going on in the world, that he's able to concentrate with such intensity and say that this is all that matters right now. So that's the kind of person who's going to be successful. It's an interesting idea. It could be, but as many understand it in terms of the fact that it's not necessarily about being dead or being in a state of suffering even, but it's that you have to recognize that it's a lot of work. You have to, if you want to have success, it's not going to come easy. It takes a year. They say in the name of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, the Rabbi Akiva Eiger said that the young man in his generation says they want to learn Shas in one night. So not only do they want to learn Shas in one night, they want to sleep that night too. They have such a reduced sense of the effort and the toil that these things take, that not only do they want it to come quickly, but even when it comes quickly, it should come easily. So that's perhaps the mentality that the Gemara is perceiving in this pasuk. So Aliyah continues with many of the halachas of Tumas Meis. In the interest of time, we will just mention one or two points from the second Aliyah. So the second, this also actually gives us a little bit of synergy because this involves the Gemara and one of the prakim that we're focusing on in this man, one of the Poland prakim, the next parak, that we read about the death of Miriam. And when Miriam dies, so they don't have no more water because the Be'er, we understand that the Be'er was there b'schus Miriam, that the Be'er was there in her honor. So some ask this astira, that the Gemara Maseches Bav Metzia and Pei Vav Midbeis, which God willing we'll get to over the course of the next few weeks, let's skip around a little bit, but it's in the section that we have highlighted for this Zman. So the Gemara Bav Metzia and Daf Pei Vav Midbeis seems to contradict this, because the Gemara says that Avraham Avinu, because of the things that he said to the Malachim when he was hosting them in Parshas Vayera, so there are certain merits that he has because of that. So the Gemara says that because of the zchus that he said, yukach nam ad mayim, that they should have some water taken for them, these guests. So because of that, that mayim, so he was zochah to the be'er. This well is in his zchus. So the Mefarshim asks, so whose zchus was it? Is it the zchus of Miriam or is it the zchus of Avram? So they have discussions, you know, the Avram, it would have been temporary because of Miriam, it lasted longer, although apparently it stopped when she died anyway. So the whole discussion about how exactly you can allot the various schus. You could say simply that this is the way schus works, that, and this is the way often you find things playing out, you find this this way in real life if you pay attention, that sometimes when a person has a certain merit, he has a certain schus in his life, so it manifests itself indirectly, that because he has excelled at a certain mitzvah, let's say, so people appreciate it, and he has that benefit, but it has to have another intermediary, that he teaches his family this midah, and therefore other people in the family are very successful in bringing about this midah, and people appreciate the family members, and ultimately the benefit accrues to the one who started the whole thing. So Avram raised a family of chesed. He raised all of his descendants to follow in his ways. That's what the pasuk says right after Kach Namat Mayim in Parshas Vayera, that Laman Yitzave Espesov Esponav Yespesov Achara, that he will teach his household to follow this way of chesed. So because Avram started this off, he taught this whole Buddha of serving the water, of taking care of his guests. So now his great-great-granddaughter Miriam took that up also, took up this midah as well. And because she has her own personal schus, so then the descendants get even more as a result of the schus that she manifested to an even greater degree. So it all starts with Avram. It's both of them are true, that the Be'er is there b'schus Miriam. But how did Miriam become Miriam? Miriam became Miriam because she was following the Masorah of Avram Avinu. And because Avram Avinu had this quality, so that was something that brought about a resulting midah in the descendants as well. So that's a point also to ponder. I'll just end with one other point. So we find now we're going to get to another parsha of Avera here as the Aliyah ends off. And Aliyah ends off in the middle of this, but tells us that the Jews are complaining yet again, and they're ganging up on Moshe and Aaron. And we have another episode that's not so positive, doesn't reflect so well on the Jews and their attitudes. So there is a little bit of an essay about this in the Sefer Som Derech, the Chevron Rosh Hashiva, Simchas Yisrael Broit, where he notes that it's really fascinating. If you look at what the Torah tells us about the behavior of the Jews throughout the 40 years in the desert, so almost every story that we have is either at the very beginning or at the very end. Basically, everything takes place in two different years of the 40 years. And in the vast middle, the 38 years in the middle, we have almost nothing. So what's pshat on that? Statistically, that's a little bit hard to understand. So he says, it seems to be that the 38 years, the Jews behaved very well. They followed the Torah the whole time. They didn't cause any problems. It's that there is a sakana, there is a danger when you're in a time of transition. And even if it's a good time of transition, but there's still a Yetzirah, that when a person is going through a point of change, so then that brings with it all kinds of challenges. So the Jews transitioning from slavery, out of slavery, from Mitzrayim into the Midbar, and then on the other end of the spectrum, coming from the Hanhaga Nisus, as the Tziv calls it, from the miraculous existence of living in the desert, to the Hanhaga Tivis stage, where they're about to go into the real life, so to speak, to the more natural way of living in Eretz Yisrael. So both of those are points of transition, and even if they're good points of transition, so that brings with it its own Yetzirahs, its own challenges, and then people have to be even more vigilant to make sure that they respond properly. That's what we find. The psychologists tell us that stress causes problems. People are stressed, so they have all kinds of issues that come along with that. And stress doesn't just mean that you're having a hard time. It could mean any change. So even if a person is undergoing a very positive change, if you're getting married, if you're starting a new job that you want, or you're starting a new experience, so that's stress too, even though it's a positive stress. They call that eustress, E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S, eustress, eu meaning good, you. So that there's a positive stress as well, but it creates tensions, and that brings with it challenges. So to any point of transition is going to provoke a response, and it's going to upset the pattern. And it's interesting just how we see that playing out with our ancestors, with the Jews in Egypt, that when everything was in a straight path, 38 years, we don't hear much about what's happening with them. But at the beginning, at the end, at these great points of transition, so there is a greater challenge that comes along with it. And we're at a point of transition now also, so going into the summer, it's the end of the school year, so the summer is a time of tremendous opportunity. You could do a lot over the summer. It's also a time of challenge. And it's a time when things change, a time of transition. And it's necessary to be aware of how, even though it could be a positive change, but it could also bring about, does by that very nature, bring about its own set of challenges. And perhaps that's also one of the messages of the Parsha, that just as we started off with, the Paraduma tells us there's nothing either good or bad, but thinking make it either good or bad, but how we relate to it, that is going to be a necessary part of the picture. Not that there isn't anything good or bad, but that even that which is good, we could still fall if we don't handle it with a proper vigilance. Perhaps that's the message of the Parah Aduma as a whole, and that's the message maybe the Egel Azav as well, and that's perhaps their relationship. And that's one of the major themes that perhaps emerges from maybe both of these aliyahs. Okay, so we'll stop here. God willing, Monday night, we'll just continue a little bit with that theme of Maivir Das Balavas, and then move on and continue, hopefully, over the next 2 weeks to get a little bit further and some significant points within the Polem Sugyas. Everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos.